The next part of our program features two extraordinary Floridians that I know you're all well familiar with, Governor Ron DeSantis and Kayleigh McEnany. I know you are familiar with many of the amazing things that they've been doing in recent years, but you may not know how many things they have in common. Both, of course, are Floridians, both grew up in Florida. They both ended up at the Harvard Law School and were involved in the law student chapter of the Federalist Society at Harvard. And amazingly, they both made it out of the Harvard Law School with their conservative constitutionalist beliefs intact, which is no small feat. They have both had extraordinary careers at a very young age while raising young children. They've both dealt with hardships such as the worst elements of our corporate media. They've dealt with breast cancer issues in their family, and they've persevered and had amazing, amazing leadership at the national level in our state. So please join me in giving a warm welcome to Governor Ron DeSantis and Kayleigh McEnany.
Is it hot? It's hot. Just so you know, both Kayleigh and I are still smarting over the Bucks losing in the playoffs.
Yes.
And then having Tom Brady retire. So, you know, growing up 20 years before the first Super Bowl, another 20 years, so we may have another 20 to wait. So we'll see what happens.
Oh, goodness, I hope not. I know all of Tampa and the McEnany family are collectively grieving together at the loss. So it's great to be here with you, Governor. You know, I drive around Florida all the time. I see license plates from everywhere, and I must say, I think that's in large part due to you and what you've done in this state. So it's really an honor to be here with you today.
So since COVID, Florida leads the nation in net in-migration. And by the way, I'm not asking for anybody to come because I like the people we have here, and it's fine. You know, but it's a free country, and I mean, I can't, I mean, I am, you know, I do what I can, but it's just, that's just the reality. And people will always ask me, okay, these people coming, you know, they're coming to a free state. Do they understand that, or are they going to kind of do the other? So when I got elected governor, there were almost 300,000 more registered Democrats in the state of Florida than Republicans. As of the end of January, there are now 60,000 more Republicans than Democrats. So that should tell you something.
It certainly does tell you a lot. Well, starting out, I want to talk a little bit about COVID-19 and the Constitution. The Constitution has been rubbing up against the First Amendment, by way of an example, freedom of religion. California rebuked 5 times at the Supreme Court on the issue of religious freedom alone. Most recently in Tandem versus Newsom, when California was rebuked for trying to regulate Bible studies in your home. You were ahead of the ballgame. You know, I was in the Trump White House. We, in May, identified places of worship as essential, performing essential services. You did that in April. What made you do that?
Well, look, I mean, at the end of the day, this is something that we had to deal with, but you do not throw people's rights out the window. And that was just something that we didn't want to do, particularly when you saw states closing houses of worship, but they'd have liquor stores could operate, strip clubs, you name it. And I just saw that as just being something that was very dangerous. And so throughout the whole time, you know, it seemed like the narrative was like no one could ever talk about individual rights. It's all about lockdown. You can't have an open state. You can't have kids in school. You can't do all that. You know, we viewed it the opposite. I mean, the default needs to be freedom. And then if there's justifications, you know, to do things for health, then it's a burden on those people to want to do it. And with the churches, there was never a basis to do it. And so we protected that, and I think that we were better for it. It's interesting, you know, we would have people, I've had people write into my office who were not allowed to get married in these other states throughout this. So they literally saying like, yeah, we went and we got married at this church in Florida. We had such a great time and everything. You know, thank you for doing that. And so when you're clamping down on that, I mean, you're not only violating people's rights, I mean, you are crushing a lot of their hopes, dreams, and aspirations, and that's just fundamentally wrong.
Absolutely. Another Orwellian thing that we've seen with COVID-19 is the mandates. And obviously, in January, the Supreme Court kind of split the baby and struck down the private sector mandates, but upheld the CMS ones. This is another example where you were ahead of the game here. In November, you banned private sector vaccine mandates in the state of Florida. What caused you to do that?
Well, you know, from the very beginning, we said this is something we'll make available to everybody. We did very good in the distribution of it, and, you know, it was very efficient focusing on seniors, but we would mandate it for nobody. It was going to be a personal choice, and that was our thing from the very beginning, December 2020. And most people were saying that at the time. Even Biden was saying the federal government doesn't have authority to mandate it. Then you started getting on into the summer and into the early fall, and this became something where they wanted to deny people the ability to work based on these shots, deny you the ability to participate in society based on the shots, and even some states deny kids the ability to go to school based on these. And so I view that as something that was very serious, because I think that would potentially marginalize a lot of people from society. I also thought it was whatever you think of mandates, and I'm not for mandates generally, but even if you would want to justify it, wouldn't the actual thing you're mandating actually have to prevent infection and transmission in the first place? I mean, to me, that would seem to be a precondition for these mandates. And so I know other states have done this. I don't even think it passes a rational basis test. What we did was basically say, you know, in Florida, you're not going to have to choose between a jab and your job. We're going to protect you. We're going to make sure that you're able to earn a living and that you can exercise your rights. And the one thing that really irked me about it was none of these mandates recognized immunity through prior infection. And you had studies in Israel, all these places showing how potent it was. CDC initially responded to that by concocting a bogus study saying vaccination was much stronger than prior infection. Recently, the CDC has had to acknowledge, didn't get a lot of attention because it doesn't fit the narrative, they had to acknowledge that with Delta, natural immunity was much more protective than mRNA vaccines. And so that's just the reality. So if you're saying you're doing this for public health purpose, but you're ignoring this core scientific fact, I think it was more about control. I think it was more about targeting people that they don't like. And I think it was an inappropriate use of not just government power, but also corporate power.
Another abuse of power, mask mandates. You know, I'm a mom of a two-year-old, so this is a very important issue to me. And you targeted these mask mandates for our kids with an executive order. Florida Department of Health came up with an emergency rule that said parents can opt out of the mask mandates for their kids. That was actually upheld by an administrative judge, so right on that.
Yeah, I mean, look, in Florida, you know, we've never mandated masks in Florida because there was never a basis to. I mean, people can wear them or not. For 100 years, it was viewed as ineffective for cloth masks with the general public. Fauci said that, and then he flipped. They had never done a clinical trial to show cloth masks. Now, actually, if you look at some of these legacy media outlets, they will have these doctors on who will say the cloth masks don't work. They wouldn't allow that 6-8 months ago, but they now acknowledge that, and I think you'll see more and more data. There have been two clinical trials, one in Denmark, one in Bangladesh. Both showed a cloth mask is really null in terms of its impact. And so, you know, that was certainly my belief. With this, when you're talking about force masking kids, you have to look at the harms that you're imposing on the kids. And so how are they developing in terms of their speech? What's the emotional toll of not being able to see people smile and see people's faces? How do you even understand people through this? Because I can't, if someone 20 feet away from me is talking through a mask, I don't know what the hell they're saying. So it's not good for education. People are now understanding that, I think. But the people who were speaking out and saying this, that there should not be forced masking of kids, they were right. And the forced maskers were wrong. And I think you're going to see more and more. There's already data coming out about speech and other types of things that kids are behind. I think you're going to see more and more. And so at best, the cloth masks make very little difference. Even if you want to look at every piece of evidence in the light most favorable to them, clearly this is not doing a major change on disease curves. And so given that, why would you possibly want to go down this road of treating these kids this way? And I think the one thing we're proud of Florida is so many other places wanted
the most defenseless people in our society, who happen to be the least vulnerable to COVID as well, they wanted them to bear the brunt of this mitigation. So a lot of these blue states that force mask the kids, you go to bars, you go to other events, and people are cavorting, and I support that, have fun, but they're making the kids be in this ridiculous state of mitigation. And so it's wrong, and you know, we acted, we were ultimately upheld on that, and our kids, I tell you, 2020, the kids would come up to me, "Governor, thank you for letting me go back, for getting me back in school." 2021 school year was, "Governor, thank you for letting me go without a mask."
Well, one of my daughter's first words was mask, so that is regrettable. It literally was one of the first. So thank you for what you've done with the mask mandates. And, you know, you mentioned it's school opening, so important. I'll never forget being in the press secretary's office, and a man named Dr. Scott Atlas, who was a lone voice among many bureaucrats in the White House, came into my office, sat down a pile of data, and said to me, "What nation sacrifices their children on the backs of COVID? And that is what we are doing. And here's the data, and here's why schools should be open." And, you know, Governor, you kept schools open. And I was a little befuddled when I tuned into a White House press briefing. I see Jen Psaki stand up there. She's asked about states distributing money to keep schools open, and she had this interesting remark. So in terms of, an example would be Florida, where they've done little to distribute money, little to no steps to distribute money to states across the state and to school districts. That's just simply not true.
Well, it's also not true. So Biden's stimulus in March, which, by the way, has helped fuel the inflation that we're seeing now, huge, huge mistake for them to have printed all that money, and they want to do even more. And that's the biggest problem ailing our economy right now. But they had done that. They included a lot of money for, quote, school reopening. We had our schools open. I didn't need any. You want to open schools? Open them. You don't need a lot of money to do it. And so we've actually distributed more than like 40 other states, but it's not for reopening because we had already done it. You know, if you go back to the June of 2020, you know, we said every parent in Florida has a right to send their kid to school in person. And we were sued by the education unions who wanted to close the schools. We were opposed uniformly by legacy corporate media outlets in Florida, but certainly the national outlets. And we were opposed by virtually every element of the left and the Democratic Party. And the thing is from a substantive perspective, it was an incredibly easy decision because the data was overwhelming that you needed to have kids in school. It was a firestorm. The teachers' unions would actually bring coffins and they would place them outside the Florida Department of Education. They would go into the school districts and they would do these ridiculous things. Just understand, if it wasn't for me, the kids would have been locked out of school in 2020 in the state of Florida. That's just the reality, because that's where all this was coming from. So we stood in the breach, we fought back, we stood for our kids, and now people are trying to rewrite history, saying, "Oh, no, we supported it. Everyone wanted the schools open." That is just not true. And so we were right on that, and they were grievously, grievously wrong.
Yeah, there's a lot of revisionist history, including today at the White House press briefing, there was something to the effect of saying, "We weren't the party that wanted to lock down." I mean, I remember a guy in a basement for more than a year who was locked down in a basement, so that's not true again. But on the subject of lockdowns, a big study out this week that the leftist press is ignoring, Johns Hopkins University did a meta study of 34 studies and found the lockdowns had little to no public health effects. And I remember one of the first times I met you, Governor, I'm in DC in the swamp, surrounded by bureaucrats like Dr. Fauci who are demanding lockdown, lockdown, lockdown. And I met this governor down in Florida a few months after that, and he was talking about how lockdowns don't work. And it seems like you were kind of vindicated by Johns Hopkins.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you look at kind of the view, I mean, you know, the open states, you know, like Florida, you know, we have, the Michigans, New York, New Jersey lockdown states, higher per capita mortality for COVID, even though we have the oldest population. But then you have some other states where if you compare like California to Florida, age-adjusted COVID mortality were about the same. They have lower overall COVID mortality rate because they're a much younger state. But they actually have more excess mortality. So you take the COVID deaths are part of that, but why do they have more excess mortality than Florida? Because they have lockdown deaths. Lockdowns absolutely had a negative public health effect on people, and certainly people who are by and large not terribly at risk from COVID. And so there was never any discussion about that. And so I remember summer of 2020, you know, south, we have a summer season. It goes up, it peaks, it starts coming down. And I knew that because I'm following the data. Fauci, he called for Florida to lock down after the infection peak. Well, why the hell would you do that? And so that's what these people were doing. But I think one of, you know, I look back at kind of lockdowns, it was supposed to be 15 days to slow the spread. The idea was, let's get PPE, let's make sure the hospitals have staffing, if you need to have more beds, all this. Now, these epidemiological models were totally, totally wrong, and those people should be held accountable for that. But it was viewed as a temporary thing. Then, as we get into April 2020, Fauci's saying, well, lock down until there's no cases or no deaths. Well, that's not possible to have no cases with an airborne respiratory virus. And so that would mean perpetual lockdowns. And so that was totally unacceptable. But throughout that whole period of time, you know, it was like all these people criticizing Florida for being open. It's interesting. Governors who criticize Florida and lock down their state always seem to find a way to get down to our state in Florida to escape their own policies. Big city mayors. Big city mayors. And I'll tell you, and anchor some of these leftist TV hosts who constantly criticize Florida, mandate masks, lockdown, all this stuff. Then they end up on the beach somewhere in South Florida. I'll tell you, one of the things I'm proud, though, is like our Floridians, they give these people hell when they see them down here because they're proud of our freedom, and they know these people have been bad-mouthing. The cherry on the sundae was when you had over New Year's, you had AOC coming down, criticizing Florida, then comes down. So we decided to make kind of a little joke about it. So we created T-shirts that said, Escape to Florida, the Lockdown Liberal Tour. And instead of having concert dates on the back, we had Governor Whitmer, March of 2021, AOC, and the dates they were all in Florida. And we sold more outside the state than we sold here because people realize how hypocritical these people are.
Well, I think you gave AOC a headache because she had to take a Twitter break and it only lasted 24 hours. But it was because of the Florida saga. She got some needed blowback for that. You know, one last question on COVID. I saw you tweeted recently about legislation to protect loved ones who want to visit their relatives in nursing homes. Very important to me. I had a grandmother who my dad says was a victim of COVID without ever having COVID because of some of these restrictions. What do you want to do to make sure this doesn't happen again?
Well, I think when COVID first hit, you know, you had to make decisions. And so the biggest decision we made in mid-March was we banned hospitals from sending COVID-positive patients back into nursing homes. Other states forced them into nursing homes. So, and we had, you know, certain mitigation that was required for nursing homes because we understood these are the most vulnerable people. Well, and I think you needed to do that. At the same time, you know, as the weeks went on, you know, we start getting in the summer 2020, these people needed to be seeing their loved ones. And so we worked with a lot of the advocates to make sure that from a state's perspective, we were encouraging visitation. Now, and same with hospitals. The hospitals didn't want anyone in either. When you're in these situations, and it's not just end of life, I mean, you're in serious situations, people need their loved ones there. This is important part of health. It's important part of a decent society. And so most of the nursing homes and hospitals in Florida have made efforts to do that. Not all of them have done it adequately, so we're looking to enact effectively a patient's bill of rights that just says, you know, if you're in a hospital, a long-term care facility, you have a right to have your loved ones there present with you. And I think that that's gonna go a long way because when you have people that are in these difficult situations and the best they can do is FaceTime or something like that, that is wholly inadequate. And one of the things that I think has irked me about COVID is when you toss aside every other consideration in society just for this one, mitigating this one respiratory virus, which, oh, by the way, you know, is airborne and a lot of this stuff, you know, the mitigation has been ineffective on. But put that aside, you have to at a minimum balance these different interests. And clearly there are huge, huge interests at stake when you're keeping loved ones out of the hospital or out of these nursing homes. And I can tell you, when we saw the nursing homes start to have more visitors, the residents, they were much happier. And, you know, we don't want people to be toiling in loneliness. And so I think a lot of places in Florida have done a good job, but I think we're probably going to have to come in and just have a minimum that's required so that we can guarantee that people have the human connection that they need.
Yeah, so important. So moving on to school choice, I'll never forget after you won the Florida governor's race, seeing an article by the Wall Street Journal editorial board about school choice moms tipping the race for Governor DeSantis. You outperformed among black women, they noted, by 11%, the GOP average. You've made good on those promises to those school choice moms, the largest bill ever signed for school choice in the history of the state. Is that right?
Yeah. So when I came in, we had about 100,000 kids on need-based scholarships. But it was maxed out because this was based on corporate tax credits. So corporations would have to write it off and then send it to this fund. And we basically reached a limit on that. And so we were able to create a new program. Family Empowerment Scholarships did not depend on corporate largesse, could just be done in the normal education system. And so probably by the end of this year, we will probably have doubled the number of kids who are on private scholarships, mostly, of course, low-income families, overrepresented. African-American kids are overrepresented. Latino kids are overrepresented. But we're also getting it more into not just people who would be considered poor, but people who would be considered more working class. Because the fact of the matter is, certain parts of our state, you know, you could have what's considered a middle-income job, and it's expensive in places like Miami. And so we've increased the income threshold so that more families can participate. I have a big package. I think you may mention some of it in terms of what we're doing to help law enforcement. One of the things we're going to put in that bill is saying any kids of law enforcement in the state of Florida are eligible for our family empowerment scholarships, regardless of income. So that'll be really exciting and another big expansion.
So I don't know if you've, I'm sure you've seen some of these videos from Bill Malusian, an excellent Fox News investigative reporter on the border, of illegal immigrants being sent through unmarked offices, put into taxis, and being dropped off at various cities. These are single adult males who should be expelled via Title 42, but they're not. Some of them dropped in Miami, and there are real consequences to this. You pointed out recently there was a 17-year-old, a man who posed as a 17-year-old, comes through the southern border. He was actually in his 20s and ended up killing a father of four in North Florida. You sent a letter to the DHS Secretary, Alejandro Mayorkas, and you said this, that illegal immigration consumes taxpayer money and burdens governmental services. Have you heard back from Mayorkas?
Probably not. I mean, like, you know, it's like, so here's the thing. So we're suing them in court on their catch and release policy. They've actually had to change it to where the people that don't show up. See, what they were doing was people would be coming across the border, and they're coming from everywhere. I mean, like, the people, anyone that thinks this is like mostly Mexicans, not even close. I mean, you had people from the Middle East, from Africa, South America, the Caribbean, you name it. They're coming through there because they know Biden ain't enforcing the border. And that's your ticket to come. Why would you want to wait and do it normally when you can come right in? And so, you know, so we were there and we kind of saw all this stuff. What they were doing, though, is, and I had state law, Greg Abbott from Texas asked me and other states, so we sent people. So they would stop the folks, they'd interdict them, but then they turned them over to the feds, and the feds would give them a notice and say, hey, call this number to schedule your deportation proceeding. Well, hell. I mean, just imagine if someone robbed your house and some prosecutor says, hey, call this number to schedule your trial for burglary. No, that's just not how it works. So there was no enforcement. They've changed it from whatever it was, notice to report to notice to appear. So now if they don't come, they are, quote, deportable. Now, we know Biden won't do that, but they would definitely be subject in potentially in the future. So we've been able to do that. We're also working through the legislature now to say some of these private carriers that are bringing people in, sometimes flights at 2 a.m, sometimes these buses. We're saying if you're facilitating an illegal migration into Florida, you're going to forfeit the ability to do business with state or local communities in Florida, and we're going to charge you restitution for every person that you're bringing into the state of Florida, because as Kaylee mentioned, there's a lot of cost to it, and we are getting money to be able to reroute them to sanctuary states like Delaware and these other places. And so, you know, what he's doing, when you have hundreds of thousands a month pouring in illegally, and he's facilitating it, it's basically the largest human smuggling operation that we've ever seen in the world. And it's causing a lot of harm to a lot of people, because these cartels are eating our lunch because of this. You know, they're abusing people, they're doing drugs, they're doing a lot of bad stuff. But he is not faithfully discharging the constitutional oath of office that he took to take care that the laws are faithfully executed. He's failing on that. And in a state like Florida, you know, we've got to do everything we can to push back against what really is not just a policy failure, but a constitutional failure as well.
Certainly true. Moving on to a contrast of kind of the safety in blue states versus red state, like here in Florida, I look at these two amazing NYPD officers who just lost their lives ambush style, Officers Mora, Officers Rivera. Their funerals were very emotional to watch, to hear from their loved ones. From that point, the point of their death, forward over the next 7 days, an officer was shot every 12 hours, roughly speaking. So there's a crisis happening with our cops, our officers in this country. You've offered them a $5,000 bonus if law enforcement wants to come to the state of Florida. And I just contrast what you've done to embrace police with what's happening in New York and LA with these liberal district attorneys.
Well, first of all, you go back to June of 2020. We never bought into the narratives against the police from the very beginning. When you started to see the disorder in these other places, we immediately called up our National Guard. We had state law enforcement ready, and the result is you didn't see what happened in those other places happen in Florida. But what they ended up doing, not only allowing the rioting, a lot of those communities took money away from law enforcement. And part of that is just bad, because you need it to be sourced. But part of it is the message that sends to the people that are wearing the uniform, that you don't got support in the community. So morale is very low. And what has the result been? You've seen huge increases in crime over the last 2 years in all of those jurisdictions. Now, part of it is taking money from police, not supporting police. Part of it is also, you know, not having abolishing cash bail in places like New York, where they put these dangerous people right back on the street. Part of it is these rogue prosecutors who just decide they're not going to prosecute crimes. So you go to a place like San Francisco, if you steal less than $1,000 from the store, they just let you go. They don't even arrest you and prosecute you for doing it. That breeds a culture of lawlessness. And so I think it's been a total train wreck what they've done. We reject all of that. In total, we are not releasing felons early in Florida. If district attorney, as we call them, state attorneys, if you have state attorneys that behave like LA and San Francisco, I'm yanking them. They're going to be gone in a New York minute. And so we see an opportunity, because morale is so low and these positions need to be filled. I mean, we have a shortage of people here in Florida just because there's such a need. So you're going to get a $5,000 signing bonus if you transfer from out of state, or if you're young and you decide to go into it here in Florida. And people, I'll tell you, I mean, they're going to be batting down the doors to come down to the state of Florida. Last year, when other communities were defunding law enforcement, we did $1,000 bonuses for every firefighter, EMT, and sworn law enforcement in the entire state. I promised to do it again, but now I've had to think, okay, we did $1,000 bonuses. I want to do it again, but with Biden inflation, I got to give them like $1,100 to be able to make good. So maybe we'll end up doing $1,100 instead of $1,000.
I support that. Moving to the courts, you've had the opportunity to appoint 5 Supreme Court justices here in the state of Florida, 2 of whom were elevated within a year to the 11th Circuit by President Trump. So I'm just wondering, there's a president named President Biden who will be appointing a replacement for Justice Stephen Breyer. Do you have any advice for him?
You know, What I found out is anything that I say or want, the White House will do the opposite. So I've honestly thought about, hey, I want to do this project in the Everglades. Maybe I should hold a press conference saying I oppose this so that they'll then fund it. So they're not going to listen to me. Look, I think one of the frustrating things about just watching the court in the modern era is, you know, you will have in these high profile cases, you know, those three liberal justices will vote the same every single time. When Justice Ginsburg was on, it was 4, and they voted the same every single time. There's no real diversity of thought. It's basically generating the type of outcomes that the liberal elites and the media and academia would want to see. I feel like on the conservative side, you know, we don't have kind of the same guarantees when some of these cases come down the pike. And if it's based on legitimate disagreements, you know, Thomas and Scalia disagreed on anonymous speech, some major things, and that can happen. But I kind of feel that it's always our side where you will have somebody just not have the fortitude or the backbone to faithfully apply the law and Constitution in situations in which it will not be popular with the elite rung of our society, where you will get smeared by corporate media, where you'll have law professors, you know, screeching and all this other stuff. And you know, someone like Justice Thomas, Scalia, didn't give a damn what any of those people thought. And I think that they were better justices as a result. And so I think whoever he picks is likely to be part of a liberal bloc that is not going to be any different in terms of the outcomes than what we typically see. We have not had a Democrat president appoint a justice who has moved at all right since John Kennedy appointed Byron White in 1962. And so hopefully someone gets on there who, you know, kind of drifts the other way into a more constitutionalist posture. But if I had to bet, I would bet that 3 years from now, whoever that person is, any of those 6-3 decisions, they're going to be on the 3 pretty much down the line.
I think that's a safe bet. But to that end, then, what do you look for in a judge? Because just, you know, masquerading and saying, I'm a member of the Federalist Society, which I'm a proud member, I was in law school, but just saying I'm a member of the Federalist Society doesn't guarantee you will get that kind of justice you're looking for.
Oh, no. I mean, look, I know people join the Federalist Society thinking it's going to help them get judge. Honestly, it doesn't make much of a difference with me at this point, because too many people are joining it thinking that that's a ticket to be able to be a judge. And so I don't care about it. And I think that, you know, you've seen judges that have been kind of FedSoc minted, you know, in the federal courts who, you know, they'll be real strong on like administrative deference and some of those, which are important issues, you know, but when the kind of the rubber meets the road on some of these decisions where, you know, they're going to face blowback from some of the quarters that I mentioned, you know, then they're not as comfortable as doing that. And look, if you honestly think the law commands the other result, fine, but a lot of these are pretty cut and dry. I mean, if you honestly believe, you know, that the Constitution, you know, says what it means what it says, that you look at text history structure, that the meaning doesn't just magically evolve and isn't ever malleable where a judge can keep reinventing it all the time. You know, if you believe in that framework, you know, a lot of these decisions, you know, you're really handcuffed in how much latitude you would actually have. And so I really think, you know, the kind of the most important ingredient, you know, does somebody have the fortitude? You have life tenure for a reason. They gave you life tenure because they didn't want you responding to kind of the winds of society. And you know, you have some like the Chief Justice who he views his job as to make the court, quote, not political, and he tries to do that by being political so that he's not seen as doing a Republican decision. So you contort the law, whether it's the Obamacare case, whether it's some of the other things under the Trump administration. And I just think that's a mistake. So what you need to do is have people who are going to be willing to apply this without fear or favor and understand that if you're doing that consistently, you are going to be targeted by certain elements of our culture and our society. And if you care what these people write or what they put on TV, then maybe you should be applying for a different job. And so that's what I'm looking for. And again, I would not want anyone to, you know, to not do what they think the law commands. But if you know what the law commands, then I think you're duty bound to see that through. And we've just had examples over the last many decades where we haven't necessarily had every justice that would be willing to do that when the lights were really hot.
Yeah, a great example of caving to the pressures of the time or the moment and ignoring the law, in my view, is Roe. And we have the Dobbs case that is pending through the court right now. Obviously, that's Mississippi, which basically bans abortion before 15 weeks with a few exceptions. And I mean, when you look at things that Ruth Bader Ginsburg said about this, I mean, just to quote her, she called Roe a heavy-handed judicial intervention, difficult to justify. Lawrence Tribe called it a verbal smokescreen, the substantive judgment of which it rests on is nowhere to be found. I mean, this was not a right decision when it came down to the law, and I wonder if the pressures of the moment will influence the court.
Well, I think that's the million-dollar question, because I think if you look, and, you know, people talk about Roe, but, you know, Casey was even more in terms of a platonic idea of we're going to just say the sweet mystery of life requires this or that, not tethered to the text, history, and structure of the Constitution. So that's kind of what they have. What that means is that's probably malleable enough to uphold Mississippi and not uproot that, because, I mean, it's not like it was really foundational to begin with. But I think most people look at that and say, okay, you know, this has not been a successful judicial effort. They've actually created whole bodies of law on, like, First Amendment things. Anything that touches abortion is almost viewed differently by the court. And so it's been really odd. And I think the main thing is that this is, you know, kind of the ultimate sacrament for the secular progressive left in this country. This is their bait. So it ends up being something that they know that they're going to face significant blowback for. So we'll see what happens on it. But I think clearly, you know, if you have a constitutionalist perspective, you know, the proper understanding of the Constitution would be that providing protections for life would be something that would be a discussion for state legislatures at the state level. And I think that's how the Constitution was viewed for, you know, the first 170, 180 years of the country's existence.
Yeah, and as we saw, we are one of seven countries that allows elective abortion after 20 weeks, and it was Chief Justice Roberts who noted in oral arguments, we have the good company of the People's Republic of China and North Korea to share our abortion law with.
Well, I think a lot of people don't quite realize how radical the American abortion regime is compared to other industrialized countries. And I think part of it is because, like, this is an issue. It's like 99.9% of the press are on, you know, pro-abortion side. Very few would be sympathetic to any type of protections for life. And so I think the public gets a distorted position. They also get a distorted view of, I think the press will present it as, you know, if Roe, Casey are overturned, then that means abortion is not allowed nationwide, when really it would kick it back to the states. And some of the justices made those points in the Dobbs oral argument. So we will see. But we are definitely not. And look, if that's what the Constitution commanded, you know, that'd be one thing. But it's an outlier based off really kind of far-flung interpretations of the text.
Yeah, another example that we may see come through the courts at some point is New York Times v. Sullivan, where you have to show actual malice to prove a libel case. It's nearly impossible for a public figure to prove actual malice. It has to be written out, essentially, word for word, the intent. You know, but you've had Justices Thomas and Gorsuch both question New York Times versus Sullivan, and Gorsuch saying specifically, large numbers of newspapers and periodicals have failed. Network news has lost most of its viewers. With their fall has come the rise of 24-hour news and online media platforms that monetize anything that garners clicks. Do you think that this is something that could be reapproached by the court?
Yeah, I think they're going to have to. I mean, I think it's just a much different landscape. And you know, Times versus Sullivan has nothing to do with government restricting speech. There's no prior restraint, no content-based regulation. This is private parties going in and basically vindicating their private rights for false reporting that damages their character, damages their reputation. And so basically what that decision says is media has a constitutional right to publish false information that's defamatory about people unless you can prove that this was a kind of a preordained thing. That's very difficult to prove, of course. The result is that, you know, lawyers, if you're negligent, you know, you can be sued. Doctors can be held accountable. A truck driver, any area of life, you could be subject to private litigation, except, you know, if you're negligent, and you have like a press badge or something. And so it was not something that the founding fathers would have recognized. It was something that we had for 170 odd years, approached it differently. And so it's something that I think clearly has not worked, in the sense of most of what is reported is just terrible. I mean, that's like very, very little, so much of it's based on anonymous sources, innuendo, all this other stuff. People have no confidence in anything that they're reading or seeing anymore. And it's really been very, I mean, they dealt with a Russia collusion conspiracy theory that was fabricated. And, you know, they knew it was fabricated because they were always anonymous sources. They make up a lot of these sources, because I can tell you, because I've had things said about me that I definitely didn't say. And so where are they getting this? They're fabricating it. I mean, that's just the reality. So I don't trust anybody to shoot straight on any of that. So I think you're going to end up seeing. You've actually seen, though, more. You know, the Nicholas Sandman, he got payments from some of these things because he was libeled. You know, you have some of these other cases that are going forward. And so, you know, I think to say that, you know, if you publish something that's false and defamatory, that you can be held accountable. Truth is a defense. If you just stick to the truth, then you don't got to worry about anything. We're only talking about false information, and we're talking about private litigation, not government regulation. And I think the founders would look at that and say, of course you can have common law causes of action for that. So I think Thomas and Gorsuch, I think they're inviting more cases to be brought. And I do think you're going to see, I think you're already seeing courts apply it in ways that are more favorable to plaintiffs to vindicate their rights. But I think you're going to end up seeing some reappraisal at the U.S. Supreme Court as well.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think there should be. I mean, when you look just during my time in the White House, the fact that the New York Times is able to publish a story that there were Russian bounties on the heads of American troops in Afghanistan, and now we find out that that was entirely false, but nevertheless, the media ran with it. There are many other examples. St. John's Church was an example. Lafayette Square was compared to Tiananmen Square, and then the Inspector General came out and said, oh, wait, that actually didn't happen. So there needs to be some accountability for sure.
Look, I mean, at the end of the day, it's one thing to be biased. It's one thing to shade things in a way that is going to reflect a certain political perspective. It's another thing to be detached from truth, to be detached from facts, and to be purely indulged in manufacturing partisan narratives. And that's basically where we are with a lot of these outlets. You know, I mean, the good thing is like, because I've thought about, like, there'll be things that are totally false about me. I'm like, you know what? I could maybe do something under Sullivan and bring a case. The problem is I don't think I could show damages because no one believes the media anyways. So I'm going to go and they're going to say, well, of course we know it's false. Everybody knows it's false.
Well said. Two final questions here for you. One is on the issue of critical race theory. You recently, I believe it was in December, you announced the Stop the Wrongs to Our Kids and Employees, the WOKE Act. Tell us about that and why it's important.
Yeah, I mean, so we banned critical race theory through our Department of Education last year. It's inconsistent with Florida standards. We are not spending taxpayer dollars to teach kids to hate each other or to hate this country. That's not happening in Florida. And we're going to be strong on that. And incidentally, I mean, you know, having K-12 standards, you know, the K-12 system is, you know, we fund certain things that we want to see taught. And so we list out all the things that have to be taught, like with American history, you know, American Revolution, Constitution, Civil War, slavery, civil rights movement, all that has to be taught in Florida, and it needs to be. But to scapegoat people or try to categorize them on the basis of race is fundamentally wrong. In the classroom, I think it's really been traumatic for a lot of kids. And, you know, we have parents of various races who say they don't like the fact that their kids are being treated this way. So I think it's wrong. So what we're doing is we're providing, you know, more enforcement for parents. Parents should have the right to access the curriculum and know what's being taught in the schools, and then have the wherewithal to be able to seek compliance with state standards. And so on the K-12, I think that's really important. We also want to defund the CRT consultants at things like universities. I mean, these people are making a fortune. They literally will say, you know, hire me to come tell you why capitalism is racist and just pay me $100,000 and I'll be happy to do that. And I'm thinking to myself, well, gee, is that how it works? I mean, so we want to totally defund that. We don't want that involved. And we also recognize that on the corporate side, you know, you have some of this stuff that's being shoved down people's throats that really raises questions about under Florida's civil rights statutes. And so we don't want somebody to have to go through, you know, this type of these types of things. And, you know, you see the stuff get reported usually in conservative, you know, the legacy corporate press. They don't want to talk about it. But if you look at, well, like AT&T and some of these companies, you know, they will actually send this to some of these conservative activists and they'll publish it. And this stuff is just totally outrageous. And so we're going to be, I think, very strong on it. My goal would be, you know, they think of Florida, now they think of the free state of Florida, which is great. But I also want Florida to be known as the brick wall against all things woke. This is where woke goes to die.
Quick follow-up before a final question. What do you think when you look at Democrats and their playbook seems to be parents have no involvement in their kids' education, CRT isn't being taught. These are just abject mistruths. And just really, I don't know why your political playbook is parents don't have a role in education. We saw it happen in Virginia.
Well, they vacillate between saying CRT is not taught in schools to then saying, you know, you're restricting freedom of speech because you don't want CRT taught in schools. So you have to pick one. I mean, if either it is or it isn't. And I think that they're very, I think they're flailing around on it because the reason they're flailing around, it's very, very unpopular. It's the same ideology that is causing places like New York to remove Thomas Jefferson's statue, Teddy Roosevelt, Boston removed Abraham Lincoln, San Francisco takes George Washington's name off the schools and all these other things. It's the same impulse, and I think what they're trying to do is they're trying to delegitimize the founding of this country. They're trying to delegitimize the foundational principles and the institutions in this country and basically refound our society in ways that are consistent with their leftist ideology, and that would be totally disastrous for this country. It's bankrupt. It's divisive. So we just, you know, our view is to speak the truth. But I think it's really tough politically to try to tell parents that they're just imagining all this stuff. I mean, like when parents come to us and say, you know, hey, this is happening here or there, I don't think they're just making that up. I mean, I think this is stuff that they're seeing. And I think to fight things like curriculum transparency and say parents shouldn't be involved in what's taught in schools, you know, that kind of gives the game away because, I mean, they view the schools as an engine for them to advance an ideology, whereas I think most parents view it as a way for their kids to be able to learn, you know, the basics and be educated in normal ways. So that's going to continue to be a battle, but I think politically it's a battle that the Democrats are going to be on the wrong side of. I mean, if you're even on the wrong side in Virginia, just imagine what that means for other states, you know, that are not quite as left of center as Virginia. And so I think, you know, the unions by supporting the closed schools, now with these left-wing politicians in the union saying parents shouldn't be involved, all the whole nine yards on everything they've done, they've really forfeited this idea that they care about education. You know, most people typically thought Democrats, you know, care more about education, you know, over the years. That was just kind of the assumption. Now you have a lot of parents who know the people that were trying to keep their kids out of school are Democrats. The people who were trying to force master's kids are Democrats. And the people that don't want them involved in what's being taught in the school are Democrats.
Yeah, well said. Final question, and it's an issue that's personal to me. I've been very public about my health journey with the BRCA2 genetic mutation, which put me at an 84% chance of breast cancer, 23% chance of ovarian cancer. Both my mom and I had preventative mastectomies, and we're happy with that decision. But it was so personal to me when I saw your amazing, strong, beautiful wife, the First Lady of Florida, Casey DeSantis, who's such a strong woman. She announced her cancer diagnosis in October. She's had her final chemo treatment. I saw on her Twitter feed a picture of a bell that she rang as a symbol of hope and faith, and it will remain in the governor's mansion. But beyond your personal story, you are calling for $100 million for cancer research in the state, a 60% increase. You announced it at Moffitt Cancer Center. That's my home I've gone to for 10 years. What made you do that?
Well, look, I mean, it's just something that when this happened, first of all, she believed something was wrong. She went in, doctor did an exam, said, you're fine. She just did not accept that. I mean, so she's like, no. And so she wanted a second opinion, and she wanted to get the mammogram. And unfortunately, you know, for us, it came back, positive. And so, you know, at that point, you know, you're like, well, gee, I mean, she, if you looked at her, she looks as healthy as anybody. You know, we have a 5-year-old, a 3-year-old, and a 1-year-old. So as this stuff goes, that is not the person, you know, the mother of 3 young kids that you want to see go through that. I mean, I'd rather it be me or something. So, you know, it was tough, but I can tell you, once we made it public, you know, the outpouring of support that she received and the prayers has just been overwhelming, and it absolutely has lifted her spirits. I think she got through the chemo better as a result of it. You know, she's got more to do. We're going to be back for scans and surgery, all this other stuff. So she's not done. But you know, I think her persistence and just saying, "I'm not taking no for an answer," and then people with their support. But what happened, I think, in that process was, you see just how many people this has touched. I mean, this is something that touches pretty much every aspect of our society, in the sense of, my mother had it. Obviously, you know, you've talked about, you, people will come up to me, you know, I beat it, she can do it, or my mother, my sister, whatever. And so we saw how significant it was really in real time. And we want to do whatever we can in Florida to be able to be ahead of the curve. Fortunately for her, the type of cancer she has, you know, they really do a good job of treating it with these therapies. And so we're going to go in and do the scan. There may not be any left. I mean, there's not, you can't feel it anymore, which is good. So we'll see what's that. So clearly it's had some positive effect. And I kind of feel like 50 years ago, we may not have been so fortunate. So all that's being said is, you know, she wants to be an advocate for people. I know she served as an inspiration for people because of the way she's handled it, and because she continues to, you know, go out and do things and make a difference for the state, not just in this realm, but in other realms. And so, you know, I said in our State of the State that we did a couple weeks ago, you know, we recognized, obviously mentioned what we want to do at the state level to help other people under similar circumstances. But we are really looking forward to 2022 being the year where we can announce, not that she has tested positive or has this, but that she'll actually be cancer free. So that's what we're looking for.
Well, my whole family will continue to pray for Casey and your family. And I can tell you this, I now know what I suspected as to why we have all those out-of-state license plates. We have a great governor and Governor Ron DeSantis.
Thank you.